groundbreaking rearrangements that give us a higher order structure in this landscape. And this conceptually tells us what the glass transition is. As you lower the temperature, you settle into one of these metabasins where you can interconvert the different local minima without breaking a cage. And you get stuck there for the observational timescale of your experiment. There are still local minima around, but they correspond more to rearrangements of free volume. Okay, so I'm going to use disconnectivity graphs throughout the talk, so I'd better ask at this point, is everything clear? The bottom of every line is the energy of a local minimum. The energy increases up the page. Epsilon here was a pair well depth, and the horizontal axis can be chosen for convenience, but it can be an order parameter. Is that okay? Right. Good, thank you. So how do we know what's at the bottom of the landscape? If we don't know that, we don't know very much. And you'll find papers that say that system doesn't have a crystal, but they're wrong. Here's the binary Leonard-Jones unit cell, which was found with basin hopping global optimization. And very simply, what you do here is minimize from any given starting point, perturb that geometry, minimize again, and accept or reject the new minimum according to your favorite criterion, which could be metropolis type, it could be threshold, it could be Salas statistics, whatever. I'm going to come back to this cluster later in the talk. These are non-icosahedral Leonard-Jones clusters, which are more difficult targets for global optimization. But you can throw this algorithm at things like the Thompson problem, which was my non-screensaver, protein structure prediction, water clusters, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Stockmayer clusters are interesting. So these are Leonard-Jones particles with a point dipole, where we predict knotted global minima for some frustrated ranges of dipole and pair interaction energy. And you can do fairly big things with this. So here's a cluster with 7,291 particles. It's actually an icosahedron of icosahedra. It's got 561 copies of a 13-atom icosahedron. It's got the colouring in each of those particles. I've managed to stop it roughly down an axis. It's an addressable potential where each particle knows where it should be according to its nearest neighbour environment. And we probably have the global minimum for this, but I don't know. The algorithm is not deterministic, so I'm not going to bet my house on that one. But here's one that I think probably will work. So I'm going to do 150 Leonard-Jones particles, and I'm going to use one core of this laptop, and this is not going to be a movie. This is going to be a demonstration. And we'll see if it's a good day. It's the 10th, isn't it? And it doesn't matter whether I use the British or the American date, because I'm just going to add the numbers together. So we're putting 150 particles in a sphere, and we're going to start basin hopping. And these are snapshots of the minima that we're moving through, and this is the lowest one so far. And the blue atoms are the ones that are most tightly bound with the lowest pair energies. The red ones have the highest pair energies, and the green ones are in between, and it already found the global minimum. So there are about 10 to the power 150 minima on this landscape. And I tried to slow it down by choosing three particles on the surface of a Mackay icosahedron, but that was a bit too fast. Shall I do another one? Okay, let's do a water cluster. Let's see how fast. So this is 15 water molecules described by rigid body intermolecular potential. It's a random starting point. It's the same deal. These are snapshots, and this is the lowest one so far. That's the energy. And here the colouring indicates the number of hydrogen bonds, the number of nearest neighbours. Let's see if I can set it spinning. There we go. Yeah.
Maybe I lost what you said. Are you running a simulation?
Yes. Yes.
Is it based on the graphs that you showed us before?
No, it's I'm just finding local minima, perturbing them, and I'm accepting or rejecting them according to whether they've got a higher or lower energy, and I'm sometimes allowing it to move uphill. I don't know that, I'm not calculating the graph yet. I'll do that later. Okay? Oh, that worked. Okay, so that's the global minimum, probably, for 15 of these water molecules. This is another one where I will bet my house on it, because it's small enough. Of course, it's very easy to make these problems much harder, and then the demonstration won't work in a finite time. Okay, so we've done lots of different systems. You can do pretty big things with this. There are many different new variations. There's free energy basin hopping. So we had several talks that mentioned cavity methods that include entropy. You can do a local free energy calculation on the fly for this. This is the ratio of approximate free energy estimates for two local minima, which involves the order of the point group and a product of vibrational normal mode frequencies. And you can find systems where the global minimum changes as a function of temperature. There are other variations on this which can do discrete and continuous metric spaces. This is useful, could be useful for optimizing the architectures of neural networks, for example. You can also do grand canonical basin hopping and semi-grand and all sorts of tricks. And to make this work efficiently, you do actually have to invest a fair amount of time in the coding. So you have to allow particle moves on the surface and other things that I haven't told you about. Now, we've seen a glassy landscape. We've seen some good structure seekers. Neither of those is probably typical. I think most things are somewhere in between, and nature has already exploited this. So here's a landscape for the puma peptide. This is called an intrinsically disordered protein. It's the P53 upregulated modulator of apoptosis protein. It's very important because if it goes wrong, you get cancer. And it's also very promiscuous. It has multiple binding partners. And this one, I think, is, yes, it's the, no, this is the potential energy disconnectivity graph. And you can see it has a number of different funnels with different amounts of secondary structure in them. And this suggests that the different partners that it binds with can recognize motifs and then stabilize those different funnels specifically. So that would be some sort of induced fit type mechanism. And I have another example of that where I'll show you the free energy landscape as well later. Yes. So that's a funnel. It's subjective. I think that's a funnel, and that's a funnel, and that's a funnel, and that's a funnel. So regions separated by high barriers with competing morphologies at the bottom of similar energies. So if you want to design a system that reliably self-assembles, you want one funnel. If you want a molecular switch, you need two, and you need to move between them somehow, like with an electric field or temperature or something. And I'll show you a double funnel landscape near the end as well.
But the number, when it's multi-funnel for you, it's like maximum 10 of them, or
well, a glassy landscape is multi-funnel, but then it's got an exponential number. So I'd call that one glassy. This is definitely in between. It's certainly not exponential. Yeah. And we'd like to know what all the different binding partners might be. Nature, according to one of my colleagues, is no more complicated than it needs to be. And this is an evolved system. So I'm going to show a couple more example landscapes. I do like this one. It's based upon some quantum dynamics. So this is the ring polymer instanton approach for water clusters. And I'll show you the rearrangement that we're interested in first. So this is a rearrangement of the water trimer, where we make and break one hydrogen bond. And it's a single transition state, so it's a nice simple pathway. This is roughly the transition state, and it's bifurcated. One water molecule is a double donor, one's a double acceptor. And you can find, you can measure the tunneling splittings that this produces. Richard Sakerley has these beautiful experiments in Berkeley with cavity ring down spectroscopy, megahertz resolution. So we have spectra to compare with, and it's mostly the motion of these protons. So these are light particles and a small barrier. That's why we get tunneling splittings. And we'd like to calculate what they are. The trouble is that quantum dynamics scales badly with size. But thanks to Stuart Allthorpe and Jeremy Richardson, colleagues in Cambridge, we have a way of doing this which scales rather well with size. And it's based upon Feynman's quantum partition function, where you discretize Q, the partition function, as a function of temperature, beta 1 over kT. And it turns out to be represented as an integral over an effective potential, UP. So this is our effective ring polymer potential. It has the original potential with p copies at different geometries, and they're coupled together by harmonic spring terms, where the spring constant depends upon the temperature and the number of replicas. And my ears pricked up when Stuart said that it's the transition states of this potential that are a finite difference approximation to instanton pathways. These enable you to calculate tunneling splittings and quantum rates. And if you've invested nearly 200 person years in algorithms to find transition states for large systems, you realize that you can just plug this in and let it run. So that's what we did. And I'm going to show you the same rearrangement. Okay, this one. Three water molecules, and it looks like we've got one copy here because we're in a local minimum. But now when I let it go, you'll see what happens at the transition state. So the light particles that are involved in the rearrangement delocalize over this landscape between two localized classical minima. So this tells you that those two protons are very quantum. This one's mostly a spectator, but actually it is a little bit quantum. And I'm showing you this because I can make a landscape out of this now. So here are some landscapes for water dimer for these path integral representations. They're at different temperatures. Here's one magnified, and we have eight copies of the classical global minimum at the bottom, and two rearrangements that enable those eight different permutation inversion isomers to interconvert. And you can see that some of the protons in this rather garish color scheme are delocalized here. We actually found some delocalized minima as well. I have no idea what those mean yet. But the structure of the landscape as a function of temperature is really interesting. So as we lower the temperature, so that's large beta, it becomes more quantum, and the transition states spread out further down the landscape, and that means that they are lowered in energy. So these three thresholds where the minima branch off are lower than at the higher temperatures. So here's one of those pathways, and now I've got 200 images between two classical minima. The yellow line is a hydrogen bond representation. And so we've got about, we've got 3,600 minus 6 degrees of freedom. And it looks almost continuous, so you can hardly see the difference between the spheres. But this enables you to calculate quantitatively tunneling splittings for this process and compare with experiment. So I like that one. I like this one as well. Normally I have to spend a long time explaining this bit of the diagram, but I think this audience probably knows it quite well. So here's a simple neural network, and my example is prediction of the outcome of molecular geometry optimization. So I've got two landscapes now, just to confuse you. One is the landscape for the loss function of a simple one-layer network, and the other is the potential energy landscape for a triatomic molecule. It has four local minima. There are three copies of the linear minimum, where one of the three atoms is in the middle, red, green, and blue. And there's an equilateral triangular minimum as well. And to generate data here, I take random points within a cube for the three possible bond lengths, and I minimize from them, and I see which of the four minima I end up in. And this triangle is a cross-section through that configuration space, and I've colored the pixels according to which minimum I land in. So this is the right answer. This is what I would like to predict. So the red pixels mean that those geometries, when I start from them, end up in this linear minimum. The gray ones correspond to the equilateral triangle. So we've got four outputs, the four different minima. We've got three inputs, which are the three bond lengths, and we've got a variable number of nodes in the hidden layer. And here's a really simple landscape. So it's for the loss function for the training set, colored according to the area under curve values that you get, and it could be training or testing in this case. But I've done the same thing to visualize how good those solutions are. So it's a softmax probability, So I have four probabilities being output, and I color the pixels according to the probability, the maximum probability for the four local minima. And so these low-lying minima here, you can see are really pretty good. They're very close to the right answer, and they are quite similar in performance. But as you go up in terms of the loss function, you get answers that are terrible. So this gives you a useless prediction of the outcome of your geometry optimization. And I've only used the initial starting geometry here for this particular test case, but we've examined it as a function of memory for frames along the minimization pathways. And of course, we've changed things like the regularization and the number of hidden nodes and so on.
So in your loss landscape, yeah. You have very many?
This one's quite sparse, actually. But if we use a small regularization parameter, you get more and more minima, and you get more minima for more hidden, for more nodes.
The bottom ones
are... Yes, they're the ones, yes, they are. And this is massively under-specified. It's not over, we're in no danger of overfitting, actually. So it's also non-degenerate, apart from permutational symmetry here as well.
So the basically three-dimensional, the
total configuration space is 3 times 3 minus 6, it's 3, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so I can use the 3 bond lengths, and it's non-redundant. Yeah. Those would be the energies of transition states. So normally when we make these disconnectivity graphs, we do this at a discrete set of energies so that things merge together at the same place. That's just to guide the eye. I can do it as a continuous function, and then every transition state would correspond to a branching point.
The transition state, should I, in some sense, have them in correspondence with saddles of the...
They are index one saddles of the loss function.
Well, can visualize them?
Yes, we certainly can. I've shown you some minima. I can do the transition states as well, if you'd like to see them. Yeah. Yes. So, any more questions about that? I can show you some more for some healthcare applications if we do that in the discussion, but I'd like to show a couple more examples within my 30 minutes first.
Is it a large hidden layer here?
No. It turns out to be fairly simple. And another interesting conclusion was, using memory, actually the point most closest to convergence is really the only one you need. You can take as many others as you like behind that, and it doesn't do you any good. And this was interesting because we've also used it to try and predict patient outcomes in hospital according to time-dependent data. So if you ask me about that, I'll show you some for some healthcare applications in the discussion. Okay, so based on some... I've had 25 minutes, so 5 more. How are we doing global thermodynamics? I'm using Bayesian sampling for this, where I couple together a good sampler for high entropy liquid-like situations like parallel tempering with global optimization at the bottom of the landscape. And this is an example for a 31-atom cluster that has two competing forms at low energy, so a double funnel landscape in this case. It has a low temperature heat capacity peak that signifies this transition and a melting transition. And this Bayesian sampling method managed to converge the heat capacity curve in about 22 minutes. And parallel tempering could do it with the same number of replicas, 32, in about 110 hours. And the problem is this bit here, because the barrier between these two local minima at the equilibrium temperature is about 30 kT. So it's a broken ergodicity problem. This method also enables you to count the number of minima. So these are results for a 75-atom cluster. It also has a solid-solid type low-temperature heat capacity peak and a melting peak. And here's a free energy landscape and a probability function as a function of the temperature and an order parameter. And so the global minimum here has D5H symmetry, but as you heat it up, you go to a minimum which is a fragment of an icosahedron over here. I think this plot might be interesting, because it's showing us the number of minima as a function of the total energy. And there are two ways you can do that. You can include all the permutation and inversion isomers, or you can just do the number of structures, and they're the same to the naked eye, aside from the lowest energy. This is a log scale. So you can see the number of minima is growing rapidly as the energy increases. And I didn't like this. Don't believe that kink there. That's probably not converged. But I didn't like this structure because it just looked like it ought to be straighter. So I ran it for longer and longer and longer. And I'm convinced that actually there is a shallow local minimum there in the density, potential energy density of local minima. And I think it corresponds to the gap in the distribution there. So we ought to try and do this for some structural glasses in the future to work out how they scale with the total energy as well.
The symmetry goes down as you go up
in temperature? The lowest energy, the global minimum has high symmetry. Yeah. And the liquid-like minima, like this one, have no point group symmetry. Yep, definitely. Okay, how am I building my kinetic transition networks? This is the last piece of the algorithmic puzzle. We're using discrete path sampling. And so in this case, I've got products and reactants, reactants capital B, products capital A, made up of sets of different local minima, little a and little b. And I would like to know the rate at which they interconvert. In general, we can have reactant, product, and other stuff, which is neither, and I've called that I for intervening, and we'll get single exponential kinetics if I can put all those local minima in steady state, and I have local equilibrium within those two endpoints. And after some pages of maths, you can work out a rate constant, a phenomenological rate constant for interconversion of B to A. SS stands for steady state. And it's the sum of all the possible pathways, so it's an infinite sum over all the paths, and these lines are supposed to represent pathways over different transition states. PI1I2 is the probability that you go from I2 to I1 if you're starting in I2. It's a conditional probability, so there's a probability of starting in minimum little b if you're in region big B. That's an equilibrium probability, and that's a waiting time tau. And if you scratch your head for long enough, you realize that this is actually Onsaga's committer probability, which is a nice, neat way to write it, CAB, the probability that the system goes to product before it returns to reactant. So that's how I'm building up these kinetic transition networks, usually starting from the bottom, and it's all geometry optimization.
But I guess you have to do some important sampling
too. Yeah, okay, so here we're trying to converge a rate constant, and we always start from a path with a barrier that's far too high. The important sampling can be done with the basin sampling part as well, if you want the thermodynamics, so we normally do that in the endpoints. Oh, you could. So I'm saving all the transitions, geometrical transition states, and you could do whatever you like for the rate constants between local minima. That could be transition path sampling. The results I'm showing you used simple harmonic transition state theory, but you can use whatever you like. So having saved them, we've got a big data. That's a good way, that's an algorithm for trying to find high points in between. Yeah, and so we use those to start the geometry optimizations to find the transition states. And we build up the network in various ways by trying to maximize the phenomenological rate constant from products to reactants to products, rather. The fastest path at a given temperature. And it's not just one. Ah, it can do. At high temperature, it's a pathway ensemble. Yeah. At low temperature, it isn't. So I think I've got time to show you one final example. 31 minutes, so I'll finish with this. Here's a double, I consider this a double funnel. I know it's subjective. So here's one funnel. It contains icosahedral type local minima, but the global minimum is a fragment of face-centered cubic lattice here. And these minima in red are based upon FCC type packing. So this is an archetypal double funnel landscape. And until 1997, it was thought that the global minimum was this one, but it isn't. And this is now a trivial problem. I showed you 150 of these particles earlier on, and that ran fairly swiftly. This is too fast to be a good demo now. It's still a good broken ergodicity demonstration, but it's also, I'm going to try and optimize the kinetics now. I'm showing you the relaxation from a high temperature distribution here in the top panel. So the initial probability of being in the icosahedral or FCC funnels is zero, but as this reduced time unit increases, we end up in global equilibrium. But at around 10 to the 9 reduced time units, it looks like we've reached some sort of equilibrium here, but it's not the global equilibrium. And there's a low temperature heat capacity peak that corresponds to the solid-solid transition and a high temperature one, which is melting. So what's actually happening here is that there is some chance of relaxing straight to the right answer, but most of the probability goes to the wrong place, and then you have to climb all the way out again to get back up here. So there are two relaxation timescales for this double funnel landscape, corresponding to the approximate plateau here and the final equilibrium one there. And we did this one in 1998, and we've been waiting since then for somebody else to do it. Of course, I'd really like some verification of our rates. So I was very excited by this paper, and the authors here point out that a previous effort used 10 to the 5 hours of CPU time on a supercomputer, and actually that one didn't find any kinetically relevant pathways. But these authors did, and it only took them 100 hours of CPU time, and I'm about to finish. So I'm going to try one more demonstration. This is pushing my luck. Because I've got negative time left, I haven't got 100 hours. So, I'm going to use all four cores of this laptop. And it's still the 10th of the 1st of 2019. So, I'm going to run discrete path sampling in the background. I'm starting at 38 Leonard Jones atoms, and I've found an initial pathway which took 3 seconds. I'm giving it a 400 local minima to start with. Here's the initial pathway. These are the Arrhenius rate constants. We're aiming for the red lines, which I know are the converged values, and the blue ones are what we've got at the moment. So we're tens of orders of magnitude too slow.
This is for the problem you just showed.
Yes. And we just found a better pathway. The rate constants improved, and you can see it's longer, but it has a lower barrier. And on the right, we're going to look at the fastest part. Okay, that was pretty good. Right, so yeah, we've nearly converged. Good. It won't converge at high temperature because there's a path entropy that we would need to calculate lots more pathways for. But at low temperature, only a few paths matter. And you can see it's got longer and lower in energy.
So here you started the initial equation was in the basin of the higher.
Here, the starting information is 400 local minima, 5 in the FCC, 395 in the icosahedral one, which has higher landscape entropy. That's what I told the program, and I asked it to find an initial connection between, I think, the lowest two from those two funnels, and then we started building up the network from that to try and increase the rate constant. We always converge from that direction because you always get a bad path to start with. So I'm done. I'll just show you the pathway if you like. Here's the fastest pathway, but it is a pathway ensemble. This is just one of them. So here's the lowest minimum in the icosahedral basin. It's got a order five axis. And at the beginning, this one it has the cube octahedral symmetry. And the color coding was the same as for the example that I showed earlier. So if I now let this go, there should be about 9 of order 10 transition states on this. And you see the colors change along the pathway because the atoms that are most tightly and weakly bound change as well. And there's no reaction mechanism or reaction coordinate that I could have guessed to produce this. So,
the color is just associated with how tightly bound they are.
Yes, it's the pair energy. It's the Leonard-Jones potential, so it's a pair energy. And I've just divided them into the most tightly bound, the least tightly bound, and the ones in between. So the most tightly bound are in the middle. And I'm finished.
Okay, thank you. Good. Do we have more questions?
Asked me to ask you about
healthcare. Oh yes, I did, didn't I? Thank you. I'll show you some more then. Hang on, let me get out of this. Oh, what? I have a stooge, right. Okay, so I'm going to define an equivalent thermodynamics for my neural networks using normal mode analysis, the product of Hessian eigenvalues, and I'm going to define a heat capacity from that, and I can break it down into contributions from different local minima, and that's how I'm generating curves like this. So there are various applications that have been done in different ways. One was sepsis prediction, one was unplanned readmission to intensive care. This is bad news. Your chances of survival are much lower, and in the US, the cost is rather high as well. So people are quite concerned about that, and there's a review here that has a lot of these landscapes in. The part that I did was really a systematic test for patient outcomes from these big databases that come from the Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital in New England, 53,000 patient data. And the outcomes that you get are patient early discharge and patient death in hospital. And my collaborator in San Francisco assured me that those should be orthogonal, but I found 483 people who had apparently been discharged early but were dead. So you really have to curate this data carefully or you get the walking dead. And I'll just come back to this one, but here are some of the landscapes for different combinations of patient data. And they're on the same scale, so the best one's probably this one. And there are three input parameters here. GCS is Glasgow Coma Score. I learned a lot doing this project. T is your patient temperature. And this one is diastolic arterial blood pressure. So this actually gives you a pretty good prediction of whether people are going to die in hospital or not. And the sooner you make that prediction, the more likely you are to intervene. But I guess for this meeting, the most important thing is how funneled they all look. So if you're in the wrong place, you don't have to go up very far to get down to the other side.
Here the space is just three or four dimensional.
Here the number of, there are 53,000 patients, and there are actually 33 different measurements. Some of them are lab measurements, other things are standard electronic healthcare data like blood pressure, temperature, breathing rate, and so on. I did all singles, all doubles, all triples, all quadruples, and then it became a bit too complicated. So I then looked at the ones that had done best here for these different triple combinations, and I tried increasing the number of features. And actually, we don't really do much better. The best predictions I got were from this one and from a combination of four different sets of data. And this is useful as well because it means there's no point measuring the other things. So some of the lab data includes things like potassium and sodium ion concentrations, urea, and all sorts of stuff.
But the other things give you clues of what they die from?
I don't have that data. Mm-hmm. And this is a problem as well. You get outliers in these databases because alcoholics always have a higher chance of dying, but they don't tell you that they're alcoholics. So you have to deduce that somehow later. And if you could exclude them from the fitting, you'd do a lot better in the predictions, and for them as well, actually. And here's the heat capacity, the analog of the heat capacity for that best solution. And I found this really interesting because it has this low temperature, and this is effective temperature in terms of cost function. It has a low temperature peak that I've magnified here. And the different lines are the contributions of different local minima as you add them up. So we have the equivalent of a melting type peak, if you like. But many of these landscapes give multiple heat capacity features, and it's the minima with very flat, small eigenvalues that contribute this. It's completely different from the molecular thermodynamics case. So you actually have to do some work with the numerics to get those things to converge properly. But I thought that was fascinating because each of these is essentially a phase transition, and it's telling you that the minima on either side of it are qualitatively different. So if you want to make better predictions, presumably you want to combine solutions that have different or complementary properties in terms of the patient outcomes. And I think that the minima that are making these heat capacity features would be a good place to start from for that, which is why I did the analysis. I don't know if that's true yet because I haven't done it. That's the idea.
Okay. Do we have more questions? One last one?
Short question. I understand that, this amazing efficiency of your method, basically based on this, identifying this funnel, multi-funnel or funnel structure.
Yeah.
But if they, they're not that obvious, like in Glassy, which you started with, then we are not in as good position, right?
We're not. So those, I will not bet my house on the global, finding the global minimum for a Glassy system. But we did find it for that binary Leonard-Jones glass former with that same method. So it does work. It'll work faster for systems, it'll work fastest for good structure-seeking systems with single funnel landscapes, obviously. It works pretty well for multi-funnel landscapes because in this accept-reject step, you're allowed to go uphill, so you can escape. And it even works for glasses, but you're going to have to run it for longer. And there are, and there's a variation called basin hopping parallel tempering, where you run replicas at different temperatures, and they can exchange copies between them. And that was what we used for some of the glassy examples, and we really needed it. It also worked quite well for some amyloid formers for looking at the Alzheimer's protein problem.
No, I guess a question about getting right one with crystal structures.
Yeah.
So, ice has regions of the phase diagram where it grows very quickly into the wrong phase. And
you mean a metastable one?
Sorry?
You mean something like cubic ice?
Yeah, metastable one, I've forgotten it's ice 12.
You normally get you get cubic ice quickly. It's a kinetic product, but it's not the thermodynamic product.
Yeah. That's but those, can you get so that you would know it should go to the other one?
For the Leonard Jones, yes, I haven't done ice, but for the Leonard Jones case, you do see FCC, HCP, and some defective structures with layers of FCC and HCP, which depend upon the box that you put it in. So you can find different crystals,
Does it depend on, so there's a characteristic, the sort of size of the nucleation of one phase in the other? And does the sort of algorithm, how it works, depend on what that gets much worse as that size gets bigger?
It probably would. Yes, if the critical nucleus is large, it'll be harder to find it. So
it has sort of some of the real dynamics in there, even when you do.
You don't have to use real dynamics, of course, because we're only trying to find the global minimums.
Right,
so we're allowed atoms pass through each other in
fake,
this algorithm.
So
it's exploiting things that nature can't do. Intentionally.
Right. Well, I guess in this case, then, if you're letting the atoms pass through each other, it may be that the critical nucleation size is just much smaller.
We've never tried it on a quasi-crystal. That would be interesting.
Well,
we should.
Yeah, because some of those grow very quickly into quasi-crystals. Some of them grow into the wrong thing.
Yeah. Okay, that would be a good thing to try.
Okay, let's thank again.
Thank you very much.